Welcome, everyone. Welcome to the Yahoo Fantasy Baseball Podcast. We're back in business. It is Monday, September 16th. Hope you're fighting for a championship like most of us are, you know, one league or another. That's why you get multiple leagues, so you can find the one league that really pays off at the end. But you know, you like to play every league till completion. I have some hits, some misses this year. I probably can win a couple of championships, but we'll see what we can do about that. This podcast is going to be a lot about looking back to what happened, what did we learn, and how do we apply that forward. And who better to discuss those things than my good friend, one of the earliest guests on this podcast. We're welcome to have him back today, Gene McCaffrey from The Athletic. You know him on Twitter at WiseGuyGene. Good morning, Mr. McCaffrey.
Good morning, Scott. It's wonderful to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you here. How's your season looking? This has been a great season, a mediocre season. What type of year have you had?
In regular full season leagues, decidedly mediocre. I only have one league that I have a chance to finish third in. However, I've done very well in DFS this year. I'm actually making a profit for the first time in my life. I still haven't won any of the big tournaments, but I've done well enough that I've won a couple of hundred bucks playing every day, and that's, to me, an accomplishment. It's also how I've been focusing. You know, I've been spending more and more time on DFS than full season because I like it better.
What's your ratio of that? What would you say your portfolio is as how much seasonal versus how much DFS? And do you think you're going to tweak that next season?
No, because I cut down on my full season leagues this year anyway in an attempt to keep better track of them because this is my problem. I mean, my problem is not drafting. My problem is not player evaluation. My problem is keeping up with everything that goes on mm-hmm. during the season. And I'm just not as good at it as, you know, the top NFBC players who I've been playing against all these years. So I'm going to try to keep it like that. I'm going to have the leagues that I'm in be more draft and hold, more best ball type formats where you can, where injuries, lower maintenance stuff, basically. And mm-hmm. this way I can maintain my DFS thing, which is to me the better game anyway. So.
No, it's a great idea that to play to your strengths. If there's a certain part of the game that you enjoy more than others or certain part of the game that you feel you're better at, why not get in formats that seem to play, they're conducive to that. So I see nothing wrong with that. I'm having an okay season. I'm going to win my hometown auction probably for the fourth time in five years. So it's really good. The trophy's sitting in my kitchen right now, and I just love the fact that my name is going to go on it again. It's been a nice run. And some other teams, I may come in second or third in the Friends and Family League, which is a 14-team league of all industry people. I'd be proud about that, although it looks like Michael Lazarus is running away with that league, and I don't think anybody's going to catch him. My Tout Wars record recent seasons has been really dreadful. I'm still waiting for Ron Chandler or Todd Zola to give me a tap on the shoulder and like put me on probation or something, because I don't know what it is about Tout Wars, but I have not been very good. It's been okay in the Tout DFS. I made the playoffs again this year, but I need to tighten up that part of my game. So it's been an okay season for me. I mean, I'm going to win at least one championship. I'm probably going to make money overall, which I guess in a sense is the name of the game. But it's, you know, it's a journey. We want to be right on things. We want to learn something. And today, takeaways are going to be our takeaway. We're going to try to figure out what just happened and if we can apply anything forward. Of course, you know, every season is a different, you know, completely different package. And who's to say that the baseball will be the same next year, that the playability of the game will be the same. Maybe there'll be changes in the rules. Who knows? But I'm going to give you the floor first, Gene. Give us a takeaway from the season. Let's bat around.
I think that the most important thing this season is not to overreact to it. This happened to be one of the years where a lot of the top pitchers did not pan out. But I don't think that that's going to continue to the degree that it happened this year. Of course, every year, you know, a certain number of players aren't going to pan out. But I still think the overall philosophy of taking a stud pitcher early, paying up for him, is the right way to go because they have so much more standings impact than even the best hitters. So I think I'm kind of happy that it happened this way this year as far as next year is concerned, because I think people are going to back off pitching, and at least as far as the very top guys are concerned, I don't think they should.
You know, I also wonder if, because a lot of the pitchers were getting hammered early or disappointments early, I wonder if maybe that colors people into thinking that the pitching wasn't as reliable as it turned out to be. I'm looking at one of my particular leagues. where I look at the top of the pitcher board. You know, Scherzer was the fifth overall pick in Yahoo drafts. He ended up having a good season. It was colored somewhat by injury, but Scherzer didn't lose anybody's leagues. Jacob DeGrom got off to a slow start. He ended up being excellent. Sale was terrible early, turned it around, and then got hurt. So I mean, I guess that goes down as a bogey, but I mean, he still struck out 218 guys. You got something from Chris Sale. Verlander probably headed towards a Cy Young season, a whip of 0.78, which is just ridiculous. Kluber, you stepped on a rake. Cole, you made a profit. Snell didn't work out. You know, Nola was, you know, up and down, but at the end of the day, he had a decent season. As you always say, Gene, they all get hit. I mean, right. You can't flip out when one guy allows six or seven runs, because it's going to happen to just about everybody. I see plenty of hits on this board. I know, you know, Noah Syndergaard kind of up and down. Trevor Bauer, I don't really know what's going on in that head of his. Walker Buehler, I think we did what we thought he would do. And then you have a guy like Jack Flaherty. I was very high on him before the season, got off to a slow start. I had a couple of opportunities to get him really cheap and didn't pull the trigger. Then later I ended up trading Charlie Blackmon in a deal to get somebody else. I got Flaherty thrown into it. That's one reason why I'm going to win one of my leagues. I got Jack Flaherty at the right time. But I look at this pitching board and I don't, you know, just back of envelope stuff. This isn't any kind of a statistical survey, but this looks like about as many hits and misses as we're going to have from any pitcher board. I think we went back 5 or 10 years, we'd see about the same hit rate for our pitchers.
Yeah, I think part of it was, as you say, an overreaction to the big offense that started the season. And, you know, in the NFBC, my first two picks were Jose Ramirez and Aaron Nola. And I was absolutely buried by the end of April. I mean, it almost didn't matter who else I had because they were just, you know, you lose like that on your first two picks. And the interesting thing is both of them have come back, but it was over. You know, there was just nothing I could do about it. It's just, I don't think I was really wrong to do that. I would have taken Cole over Nola, but to me, it was splitting hairs. But of course, it never turns out that way, does it? I mean, you say, you know, you always see players who, this guy's in this tier with that player. They never have the same season. We know that now.
I mean, I liked both Cole and Nola. I couldn't have given you a solid reason why one of them was a better pick than the other guy. And it turns out Cole ended up having the much better season. And maybe you could argue better setup in Houston. Isn't it interesting, too? He totally reinvented the type of pitcher he was. I mean, he was a ground ball guy. He was a pitch to contact guy in Pittsburgh. It wasn't that long ago that we all used to get excited when guys went to Pittsburgh with Ray Searidge, and now it seems like everybody goes to Houston, pitches out of their mind. I still remember. I'm old enough to remember when Justin Verlander was just another good pitcher in Detroit. Certainly wasn't the guy that he's been with the Astros the last couple of seasons. My first takeaway is going to be, and this is something I'm not about backpats or victory laps on this podcast, but I think this is something that we did get right here, and I'm going to apply it further next season, is that I think there's more striation in baseball now with the strengths of the teams. I think the good teams are better generally than they used to be, because the worst teams, the teams that are tanking, the teams that have several year plans, or the teams that just want to pocket the revenue sharing money and don't really care how many games they win, there's more of a gap there. And so when you identify a division that has a significant gap, and I look at the AL Central, we talked about before the season, I like the setup of the Twins roster. I knew Cleveland had talent, but I didn't think they'd have a great offense. And their offense ended up coming around. And part of that was Ramirez getting out of his funk. But those were the good teams. Chicago, okay, they're rebuilding. They have a couple of decent hitters in their lineup, but you're not a great team by any means. And then Detroit and Kansas City, look out below. It's comical how bad the Tigers are. So I thought to myself, if I can get a decent share of this Minnesota roster, it turns out the pitching staff I thought would be a little bit better. I thought Gibson would be a little bit better. I thought Perez would be a little bit better. It turned out Pineda was great. And just when he had really turned the corner, then he got hit with a suspension. But hey, there are other ways to attack the Twins. I have an over-under bet on them that cashed a long time ago, and they're probably going to win the division. That was a 3-1 bet too. And this was all based on, look, the over, I think what I did is I added up all the over-unders in every division and then took out the teams like Minnesota's over-under, just looked at the four people they're going to be playing the most. That makes up, what, like 60% of their schedule, 55%, something like that. And I think that process could have gotten us to the Twins. It could have gotten us to some teams that play in easier environments. And I think that can lead us to some fantasy value going forward. So the striation of baseball, I think, is something that we can apply. I think it worked in 2019 in a lot of areas, and I think it's going to work again next season.
Yeah, I agree with that. And another factor to consider is, you know, everyone always says you can't chase wins, but you have to chase wins. And the number of wins that starting pitchers are getting keeps shrinking. Therefore, the teams that are going to win more games are that much more appealing across the board, I think.
Love that. It's Occam's razor. It's the simplest thing in the world, but it doesn't mean it's not right. I totally agree with that idea.
Yeah, I mean, Occam was a smart guy. I mean, he applies, you know, he was a medieval philosopher. I was looking him up, and he was regarded as one of the smartest men in the world during his life. And those were back in the days where it was possible, just about possible, for an educated person to know everything there was to know. I don't know when that stopped, probably around the 1500s sometime. But, you know, given the lack of scientific knowledge at that time, it was possible to know just about everything there was to know. And he was one of those guys. So he's a hero of ours.
And, you know, as we get more sophisticated, I think there's kind of a paradox here where as we get more sophisticated and we have more StatCast data and more specific ways of measuring things, remember, we're still figuring out what all that stuff means. You had one of my favorite fantasy quotes of all time. You said about maybe 8 or 10 years ago, you said, remember, when BABIP came around, people acted like that was it. They solved it. That was the only thing that mattered. And it stopped otherwise smart people from really thinking things through. And then we found out, well, okay, BABIP is really just the tip of the iceberg. There's different kinds of contact, and there's reasons why guys can own, or, you know, a bad BABIP, a good BABIP, a fast player may have a higher BABIP. I mean, what was it? Mariano Rivera was just the luckiest pitcher in baseball for 20 years, or Tom Glavine, or, right. You know, I mean, there's a lot more nuance as to, oh, this guy's BABIP is low or it's high. That's going to normalize. That is only the tip of the iceberg. That does not by any means present itself as an answer key. I think at one point people just thought, okay, BABIP is this. They put the gavel down and they stop thinking.
Well, in a way, BABIP is a derivative stat. I remember talking about this at the time, and I think with you and Michael and Steve Moyer, and I was saying then what we really want is to be able to measure exit velocity off the bat, mm-hmm. which is a simpler statistic but was not available at that time. So BABIP was kind of a derivative by which people were trying to get velocity off the bat. Now we have that. So it's, in a way, it's simpler. And I think that when we're looking to the future, that's a really important stat. It means more than BABIP to me, much more than BABIP. And I think it's something that we should be paying attention to for hitters and for pitchers.
That's a great point. Let's go to round two of our picking through the takeaways of this season, trying to apply them forward. Gene, give us another McCaffrey takeaway.
I think that in the future, due to all the injuries and all the moving around, I think that it pays to take riskier players, especially in the mid to later rounds. I think the way to go about it next year and going forward is to try to get solid guys in the beginning and then really take chances on talent and figure that the talent will out. And if you have to wait a little bit for a player to come around, you know, get a, you know, Freddie Galvis type to hold the line until you do. But I think there's more reward than risk in the apparently risky players.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I've always been a proponent of everybody you'll consider in the first or second round has an upside anyway. I try to get as much floor with those players, as much as floor is knowable. I mean, anybody right. can get hurt. Anybody can step in a drainage ditch. You know, I'm in the middle of fantasy football right now where literally anybody can get hurt on any play. Their career could end in the next 10 seconds, as ghoulish as that sounds. And what I found myself gravitating towards is that the moment I shift from I really got to be floor driven to like the heck with floor, just grab on the upside as much as I can. That used to be something I would do late in my draft, and then it was something I did more towards the middle of my draft. I shifted that upside mode a lot quicker than I ever did and start thinking, okay, what can go right here? Can this guy be a league-winning pick? Does this guy have a 40 home run season or a 220 strikeout season, you know, or a 30-30 season percolating? And I'll just have to live with the fact that right now, you know, he only makes sense as a 15th round pick, but maybe I want him the 11th or 12th round pick. There's also a point in drafts, you know, we get so obsessed with ADP. What do things cost? And that matters to a point. If somebody had a fourth round ADP, you don't want to take them in the second round. You take them in the third round. But there comes a point where the draft shifts to just get who you like, get your guys, get the guys you believe in. And I have shifted to the point that I go into that mode a lot quicker than I ever did before.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think that's one of the reasons I haven't been doing as well, is because that's a football mentality, which I'm not familiar with at all, because I don't do football. But I think the people coming over from football to baseball have employed that mentality to their great benefit. It has handicapped the old school guys like me who said, reliability counts for so much, and it counts for less and less. So I think it is a factor in the football mentality.
Right. I think it also spills into free agent strategies, where it's like the idea is, okay, what if this guy's good? Well, okay, I might blow 50% of my fab on him. I don't care. I'm just going to go out and call my shot. Where it used to be, the room would kind of, there's almost an implied collusion where, okay, we're all going to sit back. We're not really sure if this is a real thing or not. Let's wait a while and have some more proof. You cannot, I've been saying this for a long time, wait for proof is a dead strategy now. I mean, there may be formats. And look, I get it. Not everybody likes making a bunch of reactive pickups. I'm in some daily move leagues, and I know for some people that's too much. I've even seen it suggested that even weekly fab, I know some people would prefer, let's have a monthly fab draft or fab auction. Let's do it every 2 weeks so we have more time, more data, and we're not flying blind on things. It's not, I think at one point Ron Chandler called it pinball, where you're just reacting to the slightest little bump, and then you have to make a decision because the ball's racing towards you. If you don't do something, you're going to be out of turn. But so I get it. And that's a case where we can change our formats to maybe set up the playability of the game that we prefer. But I totally agree with you. I do think a lot of that football element has weaved into baseball, and the selective aggression has really become a big part of why people win leagues, and something we need to react to. I don't know if this is confirmation bias, but my next takeaway, maybe I've just been lucky the last 2 years. Last year, I thought Blake Treinen was the closer in the B pool who could end up in the A pool at the end of the season. Right. This year, Kirby Yates was that guy for me, and that's really worked out. And coincidentally, the last couple of years, the high ticket closers have not paid out. Now, again, look, we've talked about this. I even forget if this is your quote or my quote, but I think one of us coined this, that anything can work if you pick the right players. So right. I want to be careful to not attribute significance when it's just like, hey, I landed on the right square. But for me, with closers, as we see more striation in saves, teams are more comfortable now spreading the saves out. We no longer see, although one of the cases for Yates, and I know you brought this up, is that he got all the saves after they traded Brad Hand last year. He was 100% their guy, which made it a lot easier to make the investment on Yates coming to this season. But overall in baseball, they're striating the saves more. I guess I just want to say striation about 20 times in this podcast. They're spreading them out, and it's a situation where I don't want to pay at the top of the market, because I hate the fact that when a closer goes bad, he just hurts you. He has nothing else to fall back on. I mean, when a hitter goes bad, if he stays in the lineup, you can still get counting stats. Once a closer goes bad, he loses his job and he's torching your ratios, and he's such a net loss. Anybody who took Diaz this year get absolutely crushed on it. Treinen, of course, has had a lost season. But yet, if you just want to say, well, I'm just going to sit back and pluck all the saves off the waiver wire, that may be nice if you're in an office league where maybe half the people don't care. If you're in a competitive league, you're in a knife fight for all those guys. I think there's a sweet spot between closers you can feel good about, but yet they're not the top of the market. My goal is going to try to be every next year anyway, and I think for ensuing years, who's the guy who you don't have to pay top of the market closer price for, but I could easily see sitting on 40 saves at the end of the season? I like the idea of buying in that second tier.
Yeah, Carlos Martinez. I was with you on Treinen, and I was with you on Yates, and they worked out well. It's interesting to me is that it seems to me in the years when I do terribly, I nail the closers. And in the years when I'm contending, I'm struggling to find that, extra three saves that put me over the top. And this year I just picked, I had Colomé as my second closer. I figured, well, okay, he's not going to be great, but he's going to get the saves. And, if you take him and a guy like Vasquez you did fine. You didn't have to go to the top of the market. You took your first closer in the middle of the first run and your second closer in the middle of the second run, or basically whenever you wanted to take them, because there was no real second closer run this year. It was just people kind of taking shots. And I think that's great. Because the category is so luck driven, I'd like to get rid of it altogether. But absent that, picking them has become, I think, easier than it was in the past. And I forgot, I wanted to tell you one other unbelievable mistake I made in the NFBC. The first week, because he was in the minor leagues, I dropped Mike Soroka. And I knew that that was a stupid move. So I bought him back because they called him right back up, and I got outbid for him. And I bid like over $200 of my fab money, and I still got outbid for him.
Man, it's a shame that you did the right thing. One of the great things about dropping a guy early sometimes is it's almost you're putting him on the side. You know, maybe everybody – this happens in every league I'm in where I'll notice a guy, wow, I didn't know he was dropped. How did I not realize that? And I always try to hammer to myself, audit the drops. People are going to drop players they don't want to drop. Yeah, I get it. You know, most weeks, 90% of the guys who are dropped, they're hurt. They're valueless. They've lost jobs. They've gone to the minors, whatever it is. But players of interest who get dropped are players who just need one very simple thing to happen. In the case of Soroka, he just needed to come back up to the team. I mean, everybody liked his pedigree. So, you know, I think auditing the drops is something I need to do a better job of next season. I'll also mention one thing that I've been doing for a while that seems to work pretty well with relievers. Again, it's not going to hit all the time. But rather than chase the previous middle relief heroes, I just look at walks and strikeouts early in the season and try to figure out a reliever who may have put something together, maybe added a new pitch, new rubber position, new catcher, new pitching coach. Who the heck knows what it is? Maybe it's just getting a chance to play. And Nick Anderson was one of the hits for that. Just all I did is look and say, okay, this guy's got a bunch of strikeouts. He's not walking anybody. Pitches for Miami. Now, I kept thinking this guy had latent save upside because I didn't think Romo would be long for their closer gig. He had it for about half the season. And by the way, if you had the guts to pick Romo, you really got your money's worth. But, you know, Anderson hasn't really been a save guy. He's since been traded to the Rays where he's been outstanding. He finally allowed a run. The other day he allowed a home run to Rougned Odor, and it was a nasty pitch. Odor just hit. It's funny how a lot of times, you know, every pitcher goes out of the park. Oh, it's a mistake. I mean, no. This was a great pitch, and Odor somehow squared it. I don't know how he did it. Maybe just Odor's locked in right now. That guy's frustrated me most of the year, and he's going to hit 30 home runs anyway. But Nick Anderson, all you have to do is see the strikeouts and the walks early on. It's funny how we get more sophisticated, how walks and strikeouts still tell so much of the story. And what I'll do next year is when somebody pays $7 or $8 for Nick Anderson, I'll just kind of shrug and say, okay, maybe he'll be good again, and I'll try to find the next Nick Anderson 3 or 4 weeks into the season.
Right, although I don't think he's going to be terribly, you know, hotly pursued next year.
No, maybe not. That could be true. That could be true. And, you know, isn't it funny? I never know exactly how far to go with this, but isn't it funny how often the Rays are right with these guys? They traded Chris Archer, and, you know, they got Glasnow, who was having a breakout year before he got hurt, and they got Austin Meadows, who's a really good football player, really good baseball player. It's just interesting how, man, the Astros keep guessing right. The Cardinals are always good. Yeah, the Rays keep doing a lot of things right. At some point, even if we don't have attribution to why, and maybe I'm conveniently forgetting when they miss on a guy, as they all do, but it sure seems like there are some teams that get it and some teams that don't.
Yeah, and don't forget the Dodgers.
Was it eight straight in the National League West rounds? I mean, man. That's ridiculous. I know it hasn't been the strongest division, but I mean, given that the Giants have won 3 championships in this decade or in recent years, to win any division 8 times in a row, I don't care. I mean, I know people mock like the Patriots winning the AFC East all the time. Oh, the division stinks. It's hard to win all the time. Things go wrong. People get hurt. You just have a season where you don't get any breaks. You know, hats off to the Dodgers, who I think clinched probably sometime around August 1st. I mean, man, I don't even know how they've stayed focused the last few weeks because they really have nothing to play for right now other than just thinking about October.
Yeah, well, that's what they're thinking about because their World Series are bust this year. I mean, Absolutely. They've got their best team. And they really, you know, they have to win this year. And so I think that's, you know, they still got the taste of that terrible loss a couple of years ago. And they, when they, you know, you can argue that they should have won that game and therefore they should have won the World Series, but yeah. They should win this year. I know the Yankees and the Astros are both very good teams, but that's what the Dodgers have to focus on. That's what they're going to focus on.
Yeah, you know, I think I'm rooting for the Dodger-Astro Super Bowl. I don't know why I have so much football in my mind. The World Series, that's what the Baseball Championship Series is called, the World Series. I'd like to see an Astros-Dodgers rematch. People love their Cinderellas early in seasons, whatever. But I think I just want to see the two best teams. And to me, they're clearing away the two best teams. Although I got to give the Yankees credit, too.
Yeah.
Look at all the guys they had hurt, right? And somehow there they are. They've dominated a pretty good division. I'm still not exactly sure how they did it. But, man, somebody, whether it's Cashman, whether it's Boone, somebody deserves a ton of credit there.
yeah, well, if they get Severino back and he's good, then they're going to be, you know, they're going to be a one tough opponent for the Astros. I mean, that's going to be a great series, and I'm assuming that that is going to be the ALCS. It's got to be. I mean, they're so, to me, they're miles above, you know, the Twins and whoever wins the wild card. I mean, the wild card teams are so obviously flawed, and so they should be, if there's any justice in this world, be out quickly.
Not yet. The Twins seem like a regular season team to me. They hit all these home runs. They pile on the bad pitching, but they don't have enough front end pitching. I was hoping Barrios was maybe going to take a step forward this year that he didn't take. He was fine. I mean, you took Barrios, he gave you what you wanted, but I thought he might get a little bit better and be a true ace. I'm not sure he's at that level yet. And I wonder how much, you know, they hit all these home runs, you know, they've set records, but I wonder how much of that is, you know, okay, what number five, number four, number five pitcher are we piling on today? You don't face those guys in October.
Yeah, and I actually have my eye on Berrios for next year because I think that I'm curious to see how he finishes because he's still, I mean, he hasn't lost an ounce of his talent. Mm-hmm. His results have been, you know, not a disappointment either, but I mean, he didn't step up, but he didn't step back either. So, I mean, that's a good sign to me. There's another thing I wanted to mention about when you were talking about the guys who were striking out guys and not walking guys, is the guys who were just striking out guys. Now, I mean, I flopped big time this year with Josh James, but he's so awesome. And I think the Astros, we know that they're right about these players often enough. We can see this is the flaw in this guy's game, but it's the sort of thing that can turn around any time. And I noticed they're still giving him every opportunity to be the kind of dominant middle inning guy that they're going to need in the playoffs. So I wouldn't be surprised if he was a postseason hero. Of course, I wouldn't be surprised if he was a bust either. But to me, how Josh James goes is how the Astros are going to go in the postseason.
I think there's a chance next year maybe he could be this year's Lucas Giolito. Is there a takeaway from Giolito other than when a guy's talented, don't care how bad he is early in his career? Sometimes the light goes on, and it was very early in the season we could see that Giolito was going to be a difference maker.
Yeah, of course, with a guy like that, you can't ever pay serious money for him. But I think I don't know what he went for in the AL auctions, but I know in the mixed league drafts, he was basically a reserve pick, which is what he should have been. But, I mean, that's a takeaway. I mean, go for those guys, the high upside, the pedigree guys who have flopped, because at any time they can, you know, get synced in and, you know, the scouts know what they're doing, and they should always be respected, and at least in terms of taking a late shot at a guy.
Yeah, one takeaway I'm going to have, and we've been talking about it a lot on this podcast during the season, is I just think I need to reevaluate what contact means to me. Of course, we're in a time now where there's no shame striking out. It used to be time in baseball where strikeout was a shameful act for a hitter, and people would choke up and try to go the other way, or just try to get the bat in the ball with two strikes. They didn't want to strike out. And now it's like, okay, you strike out 150, 170, 180 times. Nobody cares, as long as when you make contact, something good might happen. But I think I need to reevaluate how much I value the rare hitters who do get contact on the ball. And also the pitchers. This is maybe the bigger part of this takeaway, is that I was open-minded to Porcello and Michaelis and Kyle Hendricks. And, you know, those guys have had varying success. Hendricks has actually had a pretty good season. Michaelis, a little bit up and down. Porcello has torched my ratios like he has a personal vendetta against me. And maybe that speaks to the danger of that division too. But now, of course, if the market totally collapses on those guys and I'm being given away them at no cost, then maybe I might just decide it's worth it to take a flyer or put them on my bench. But I'm going to reevaluate how I play the contact game next year, both for hitters and I think especially for pitchers, because we're at a time now where if you can't strike out at least a batter per inning, I'm not sure I can trust you on my roster.
Yeah, it's true. You certainly can't have two low K guys or you're gonna suffer. One is okay.
Get one more takeaway for us?
You know, I like power speed guys next year, and I like the way stolen bases have also worked out, and they're down, but there's a lot of players who are getting a few. And I think early on, if you get yourself a decent base of stolen bases, and there are plenty of guys in the first couple of rounds who'll give them to you, I think it's really easy to pick off after that guys who are going to give you between 10 and 20 stolen bases. And again, a category that's often a problem for me is a lot easier to solve.
Yeah, it's funny. One of the guys I did get this year who worked out, who's a power speed guy, is Jonathan Villar. And it's interesting how often you see guys who steal a bunch of bases on teams that aren't good. And I almost wonder if they just think it's part of what they have to sell, or they just don't, they have a DGAF approach. You know, look at some of the stolen base leaders this year. Malik Smith, Adalberto Mondesi, VR's on that list. Jared Dyson stole a lot of bases with Arizona when he got a chance to play. I just wonder if maybe that's more, it's almost like a currency of the lesser teams, right? They just figure, okay, what do we care? We're not selling anything here. Ironically enough, it was VR who hit the home run, who set the major league record for most home runs in a collective season. But generally, my goal is to not have Malik Smiths on my team, is to have a approach where most of my primary players, at least steal a little bit. I mean, your first baseman may not run, your catchers are never going to run, but I like it if my early picks at least can get 10 or 15 and maybe have the upside for more. And so that it keeps you away from the one trick ponies, having to roster Delino DeShields or Malik Smith, guys who you don't trust their batting average, G Gordon, whatever it is. I like to avoid those guys on my team. And by the way, Gene, you talked about, you know, what you're going to draft next year. And this will transition us into our draft. And I'm sorry if you want us to draft cereals, if you wanted to draft, you know, our favorite drummers, maybe we'll do that next year. We're actually going to do a baseball draft today. It's actually going to be very topical, hopefully actionable. Gene and I are going to go five rounds each, and we're going to draft, basically do a mock draft for the 2020 fantasy baseball season. We're going to give you the answer code right now. So you can just, you know, never buy a magazine, never subscribe to a website. You have all the answers. The 10 commandments are being handed to you right now. We're going to give you the 10 right picks. And Gene, because I'm a sporting guy, I'm going to give you anybody in fantasy baseball for 2020. You have the first pick in our mock draft 2020.
Well, you know, it's easy to say Trout. So I'm going to say Trout, even though I think Yelich or even Acuna is viable there. I'm just going to go with the money, take Mike Trout. So the field is yours, sir.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I rail about this a little bit to the point of maybe being pedantic. A lot of times people will say, oh, well, how often is the number one pick, you know, the number one player in fantasy? And I don't care about that. All I care about, and this is a word you use a lot, is a foundation. I want a guy to put that brick down. I want a guy, all I want Mike Trout to do, or whoever my first pick is to be good, is to be really good, hopefully be healthy. And then, you know, Mike Trout doesn't have bad seasons. Even the year he did get hurt and missed, 40 or 50 games, he still had an outstanding season. So, I mean, nothing wrong with Trout. You know, I always do these drafts back and forth. We never snake, and I've never wanted to snake as badly as I do right now, because I think Yelich and Acuna are great picks. And if I could snake, I could get both of them. But because I can't snake, I have to make a choice on one. And I'm going to go Yelich, just because he's done it at this level twice in a row. And I'm assuming the kneecap thing won't be a problem for next year. He's a guy capable of winning a batting title. He's capable, I guess, of winning a home run title. He still wants to run. I'm not really sure that's all that important or valuable to the game anymore, but he's interested in doing it. I also like, this is something about Yelich, not that any of these guys aren't smart or don't care about their craft, but I just like the way he approaches the game. When they asked him about regression, he had a very reasonable answer about it. The park fits him really well. They usually have a good lineup around him. It kills me that I'm probably going to give you Acuna on the way back, but I'm going to take Christian Yelich. And if I have the first pick in one of my keeper leagues, I may pick first next year. I'm sure Yelich will be part of that conversation.
Yeah, he has to be. One of the things about him was that this power that he shows was latent. It was there in Miami, but he was just thinking to himself, why should I make 400-foot outs in that ballpark? And so I'm going to hit the ball on the ground and hit line drives and hit 300 because that's the best way to do it. And as soon as he got out of there, he said, okay, now I can hit home runs. I think he's absolutely 100% legitimate, and there's no real reason why I took Trout over him except the slight edge in track record and floor. You know, although I think Yelich has a really high floor too. So, yes, I'm going to take Acuna next because I like guys who steal 36 bases while they're hitting 39 home runs.
And do what is he, 21, 22? I mean, yeah, what he's doing at this age is just absurd.
Yeah, there's nothing he can't do on a field. And if anything, he's got upside off where he did because he's hitting what? He's hitting 280 or 278 he's hitting. Yeah, I mean, there's no reason why he can't hit 300 too. So, and or in an on-base percentage league, you know, his batting average component of OBP should rise too. So he's absolutely defensible as the first pick and pretty much automatic if somebody's taking Yelich and Trout.
Yeah, I think this could be easily be the top three in a lot of leagues. And now I feel like a lot of paths are open to me. I'm going to take Cody Bellinger for a few different reasons. I mean, obviously, I think it's true. He didn't hit a home run as a senior in high school, which just blows my mind. And it just shows how these guys have development curves. 44 home runs as we speak, 304 average. You know that the lineup around him is going to be really strong. And I care about that. To me, lineup protection it's in the definitions that we get lost. It isn't that people have to pitch to Bellinger because they're afraid of everybody else. I think lineup protection means there's somebody on base when you come up. And when you get on base, somebody knocks you in. I want that merry-go-round to go as long as it can. And I feel like the Dodgers, you opened the season, remember having a home run derby against Zach Greinke, which was got some people off the Greinke scent. What an awesome season he had. And talk about a guy who knows how to win with diminished stuff. I mean, his miles per hour is around 90 right now. He can't get stopped for speeding with his fastball, but he's so smart with his off-speed pitches. And Bellinger will steal a base. I mean, 12 stolen bases. And the thing that really gets me excited, and there aren't that many hitters who do this, he's got 91 walks and 102 strikeouts. So that's right now an elite contact rate in today's game and almost an even ratio of walks to strikeouts. Any player who does that, especially if he's hitting the ball with as much authority as Bellinger is, that's an elite player. So he may qualify first in the outfield next year again too, which is a nice little feather in the cap. It's far down the list of criteria. But in our mock draft for 2020 with the fourth pick, I'm going to take Cody Bellinger.
And then I will respond by taking Mookie Betts.
Yeah, yeah.
Hell of a down year, Mookie. So he has been a little bit of an on and off kind of guy. And this should be one of his on years. But, you know, he's had a hell of a season. He's leading the major leagues in runs scored, the forgotten category, by 10.
Love runs scored. Love runs scored, man. That's my favorite fantasy stat. I know it sounds silly to say it, but those guys, why is it the guy, if a guy drives in 130 runs, we throw a parade for him. He's got 131 runs. He might have gotten 140 or 150 if he hadn't gotten hurt. And nobody ever, we might talk about it, but that's a stat that gets no play, no buzz. You know, there's no SportsCenter segment on it. It's just a stat that, and if you get guys who score runs, that means they probably hit in good lineup slots. That means they probably get on base. They probably walk a decent amount. They probably run the bases well.
Yeah, I mean, nothing has changed in his game, and he was the consensus second pick this year. It just didn't happen to work out, but it's quite likely to work out better next year.
You know, one of the things I love about Betts, and I think again, I'm probably stealing this from Gene McCaffrey, pros of old, is he played hurt a couple of years ago. I guess the year before his MVP season, he had a bad thumb. He had 264, which is just a fluke of the century. He played hurt, but he stayed on the field and played. He still gave us like 150 games. And you know that willingness to stay on the field and play hurt and produce to the counting numbers. We didn't get the season we wanted from Betts. But I remember saying the next year, look, try to get this guy wherever you can. He just had his worst season. And it was still, I think he came in fifth in the MVP voting, you know, part of that because of his defense. Right. But still, this is his bad season. This is like everything bottomed out for him other than a major injury where he couldn't play. This is about the worst season he could have. And you still... we got a nice foundation there. Yeah, I think Betts is a great top of the first round pick. I'm going to take a guy who reminds me a lot of Betts, even though he plays a different position. I'm going to take Francisco Lindor, who was hurt at the beginning of this year and got off to a little bit of a slow start, but really picked it up. That Indians lineup, once they got Ramirez going, I mean, I was picking on the Indians halfway through the season, but they really got it going with their offense. Lindor does everything. I mean, he can help you in all five categories. There aren't that many players who do that. He's at a really nice age pocket. I've tried to trend a little bit younger. I think for a long time I was the Ibanez All-Stars guy, the older player sympathizer. I still think there's a time for that, but you want your young players to be your early picks to be in the pocket where they're on the way up or they're at least at a really good area where they're close to their theoretical picks. To me, that's Lindor. I don't care so much that he's filling shortstop. There are enough good shortstops to go around. There aren't that many elite shortstops, though. Right now, I really just want the stats. I wouldn't care if he was a third baseman or a catcher. Well, actually, a catcher I'd love, or an outfielder or whatever. I just know that he's a five-category contributor. Again, he may have just had a down season for him, and it's still return for me, first-round value.
He has to be taken in the first round. He's a no-brainer to me, and he's having a hell of a year, you know. I mean, nobody's losing because they took Francisco Lindor in the first round.
Absolutely.
As you said before, is it my pick now?
It is your pick now.
I'm taking Jacob DeGrom because I still think he's the best pitcher in baseball. It's kind of hard to derive that from this season, but he's certainly right up there any way you want to measure it. I think he's closest to his peak of the four guys who I consider the elite starting pitchers, DeGrom, Verlander, Cole, and Scherzer, in no particular order. But I think that DeGrom is the best of those. It's a fact that the dominant starting pitcher has more standings impact than any player, any hitters, and it's not even close. And there's no shortage of really good hitting coming up, you know, in the second and third round. So if I was in this position in a draft, I would definitely take DeGrom.
Yeah, I think he's a great pick, and I'm going to piggyback it, but I'm going to take Gerrit Cole with the hope and assumption that he stays with the Astros. 292 strikeouts, even in a day and age where 200 strikeouts, they're handing out those seasons at the airport. I mean, like 20 guys are going to do it. But 292, and he's on the Astros. It's a pitcher park. He's supported by all this good infrastructure. You know, Verlander's season is right there with it, and Verlander actually has a much lower whip. But, you know, he's at an age where you have to worry at some point. It's just inevitable that there could be a drop-off. To me, Cole, nothing wrong with DeGrom, of course, and attacking the division. I think, you know, the Marlins are still going to stink. There's going to be good spots. And the National League still has the pitcher, so, you know, they get a rally going, and then they get a bunt and give you an out anyway. Nothing wrong with DeGrom. With Cole on the Astros, I think if he sticks there, and no guarantee he will, he'll be the number one pitcher on my board next year.
Okay. I mean, I think it's very arguable. I don't think there's any of the top four. You can make a case for any of them, including Verlander, as old as he is, because, you know, what's going to be different in 6 months? And that's, I mean, he is what he is now. And even if he falls back a little, his chance of being really good is really good. So even if you rank him fourth, I think that you're in a good spot by taking an elite pitcher in that part of the draft.
Okay. Two more picks for each of one more pick for each of us and two more picks to wrap up this draft. Your fifth pick in the 2020 mock draft.
I think I would take Trevor Story.
That's who I wanted.
Well, I mean, there's nothing he can't do either. And as long as he's in Colorado, and, I love that he's been batting first and second because I love those extra plate appearances. Maybe you should bat second for RBIs, but for the benefit of the team, you should bat first. But that's another issue. There's nothing he can't do. He's right there. He's got really good speed, so I think his stolen bases are going to hold up. And as far as the rest of the game is concerned, there's really no doubt about it. Just keep him on the field.
And, you know, he's got the elite speed. I think he's at 20 stolen bases right now. Again, you know, why would you ever really need to steal a base in Colorado? You're in scoring position the moment you step into the batter's box. But good at everything. I think he was a misunderstood player for a long time. People didn't realize that the strikeouts weren't that big of a deal. And I think he was – last year he went in the second round of some drafts, and it drove me crazy whenever I saw somebody. Like, I'd have the fifth or sixth pick. I wouldn't be ready to take Story yet. And then I'd see him – dipping in the second round. I'm like, oh God, why don't I have a pick now where I can take him? Because I would jump all over him. I always also like, you know, it's just something about the peace of mind of having a piece of Colorado. They just play so many 13, 11 games. And when they do that, and you have Trevor Story or Nolan Arenado or Charlie Blackman, you have a piece of it. And it's very rare. I can't remember. I can count on like one hand a day where that offense went nuts and like Arenado went 0-for-5 or Story went 0-for-5. It just doesn't happen. I mean, it's such an unfair advantage. And why run uphill when you can run downhill? Colorado's still the ultimate downhill park. And, you know, it may be more important next year because we've been really doing well with this Texas outdoor stadium. They're moving indoors next year. Who's to say if that will be – I mean, maybe that'll be a neutral park. Maybe that will be a pitcher park. So enjoy these final – Arlington games while you can. I'm looking at the batter board and a lot of guys I could take here. I think Devers would make sense. Nobody's ever regretted taking Arenado. I wonder when Anthony Rendon is going to graduate to the first round, which I think would perfectly make sense. We're both big Freddie Freeman fans. Juan Soto coming up early in his career is in a really good pocket. Alex Bregman is good at everything. I think the Astros are too smart to run a lot, so I don't know that he'll ever have the stolen bases, but he's good at everything else. But because I see a lot of these hitters looking the same, I'd be fine with any of them to get to me in the second round. I think Rendon would kind of be my second round hope. I'm going to take another pitcher. I'm going to take Justin Verlander. It could be Scherzer. It could be Verlander. They're both on good teams. They're both in, I think, favorable divisions. They both have the type of work ethic and body type that I think will age well. Even, you know, Verlander allows a few home runs. That's okay. I love the fact that this guy, you know, for all the laugh that we always got when, you know, Jack Morris pitched to the score and everything, Verlander pitches to the score. He admits he's not trying to throw every pitch match velocity because he wants to be able to dial it up to 98 or 99 when he needs it in the seventh inning. There might be a couple of guys on base. Maybe it's not exactly a comp to what Morris was talking about, but Verlander admits, look, he's modulating that velocity during the game, so he has some of it later. I think there's plenty left in this guy's tank. He's a first-round pick, and I'm going to make him a first-round pick to close out our 2020 mock draft. All right, we've done it, man. We have solved it. This is, you know, students will go back and study this draft, Gene, and hopefully it will be the blueprint for Yahoo showers, and maybe I'll actually contend in Tout Wars for the first time in like 7 or 8 years. Don't throw me out of Tout Wars, guys. I love that league so much.
I
know.
I feel that way too about Tout Wars because I'm having a terrible season too. You know what my big thing was? And I put myself behind the eight ball in Tout Wars by bidding $28 for Cody Bellinger. And, you know, my buddy John Mena was next to me and he gave me a look like, I don't think you should have done that. And then that was the one thing that worked out great. Isn't that the way baseball goes?
Right, right. Well, you have DeGrom in that league too, right? Well, at least that's been a couple of hits.
Yeah, well, I had DeGrom in that league, but my secondary pitching has just been atrocious, especially at the start. Darvish and Mats, I mean, they were my two and three, and they just got hammered. And that's, my pitching has been awful. Because you get a great pitcher, you still got to back him up, you know?
Sure, yeah. My big four, and this is an OBP league, where Harper, Votto, Carpenter, and I forget who the fourth guy was. And isn't it funny? Tell me what the takeaway is on this, if there's any takeaway. Matt Carpenter was, you know, I guess I just have to lose the – I have an affection for that guy, and I have to give it up. I have to admit that he's at a point in his career I can't trust him anymore. But he was terrible last year for about 6 weeks, and people weren't sure what to do about Carpenter. I know in one league I was trying to get rid of him. I couldn't give him away, but I was willing to trade him at discount. Couldn't do it. And then he just totally picked up. He was arguably in the MVP conversation for a while. He had about 3.5 months where the guy couldn't miss. And so when he got off to a slow start this year, it's like, well, I mean, I've seen this before. I waited and waited and waited and waited. And who's to say how hurt he is? And we know, right, once the season ends, we're going to hear, oh, yeah, you know, this guy's elbow has been barking for months, this guy's shoulder. It's part of that is we have to try to figure that out and make rational guesses during the season. But, you know, I like to say, and I say it a little bit with pithiness and maybe even with a little bit of, I don't know, just some sour grapes. But, you know, everybody comes around except when they don't. You know, Matt Carpenter, you were patient. You were paid. You paid off 2 years ago. It didn't pay off this season.
Yeah, well, he's a guy. He may have another run in him. If he is playing hurt, well, that's a good excuse. I think he's a guy it'll pay to watch his spring next year, you know, especially towards the end of spring when they're facing actual real pitchers and see how he's doing. And then maybe – because he's going to fall a long way this year. So maybe he's got one more run left in him, and I'll be looking at that.
You know, I love the excused absence. I think of somebody like Eddie Rosario, who was playing at a first-round level last year in the first half, and then he got hurt, played through the injury, didn't play particularly well. And if you just said, okay, he showed me what he can do in the first half, he played through a major injury in the second half, I'm going to treat him as the player he was in the first half. Not that Rosario was a huge hit this year, because, I mean, 275, 85 runs, 31 home runs, 99 RBIs. That's never been less valuable than it is right now. Right. It's a really good season. But, I mean, that was like a second round season not that long ago. Now it's more probably like a fourth round season. But still, the excused absence is always a big thing for me. And I guess I have to determine over the winter if I view this as an excused absence or not for Carpenter. But there's a case of not only was I too patient with holding on to him, at one point in Tout when he was on the disabled list or the injured list, they're calling it now, I could have cut him and taken the fab money. I could have gotten a huge fab kickback. And I was thinking about it. I'm like, you know, is this guy worth $300 in fab or whatever I paid for him times 10? You know, maybe he would have been. You know, maybe I could have offered him around. I know at one point in Tout this year, I offered around Gossman to people and you paid for him. And, you know, so I feel bad. I feel like I had an infection and I gave it to you, Gene, with Kevin Gossman. But
no, it was my own fault. It was but on the other hand, I mean, since he's been traded, he's been pitching really well. I don't know if you noticed that. But
yeah, he has for the Reds. Yeah. It's funny how that works. Fultonavich is another guy who was just stepping right on a rake. But, man, he's been great. He's on one of the teams I'm contending in is the Great Fantasy Baseball Invitational. I can't win that league. Todd Zola, to his credit, is running away with that league. But I might be able to come in the top five. And I have Fultonavich on my bench. I'm afraid to play him. Last week he started twice. Would have been a great time to dial him up. I sure could have used two wins, which is what he gave me. My bench fortified by that. So,
right.
You know, it's hard. It's hard when you're burnt by a guy to jump back in. And sometimes you just have to, you know, they say a great defensive back has to have a short memory, or a great closer in baseball has to have a short memory. And maybe fantasy baseball owners need that as well. I'm glad I had a long memory to get Gene McCaffrey back in here. He was one of our openers early in the season. He's one of our closers as we are very close to closing the book on the Fantasy Baseball Podcast for this year. We're going to have one more episode. I want to thank Gene for his diligence, for his wisdom, for his great work on Wise Guy Gene on Twitter. Gene, give our listeners an idea of what you're up to and how they can keep up with you.
Well, I got two more columns every Tuesday in The Athletic. Then the fantasy baseball coverage ends, to be picked up again next February. In the meantime, I'll be writing Wise Guy Baseball 2020, much of which will appear in the Athletic. And I'm honored to be there. And I'm thankful to you for having me twice, not once. And look forward to talking to you next year and over the winter.
Yeah, can't wait. And you know, next time I have you on, we'll do a little rock and roll segment of some sort. Maybe we'll get those best drummer list. We'll go on, because Gene is a renaissance man on many topics. And man, pick up Wise Guy Baseball. I've said this before. Gene McCaffrey isn't my favorite fantasy baseball writer. He's my favorite baseball writer. I mean, there's nobody who I enjoy more. His stuff is intelligent yet very readable. It's pithy. It's funny without trying to be funny. And it's very smart. It will make you think. It will make you a better player. It will make you a better thinker. And that's really the best endorsement I can give of any writer or any friend for that matter. So we're really lucky to have Gene on a couple of times this year. And we'll certainly do the same thing next year. Well, that's a wrap on this edition of the Fantasy Yahoo Fantasy Baseball Podcast. I'm Scott Pianowski. For my producer, Brett Rader, doing an awesome job all year, making us sound great. For our guest this week, Gene McCaffrey, who never misses. And again, he didn't miss this week. I'm Scott Pianowski. Hey, keep grinding, man. This stuff, whether you're moving up a couple places in the standings, you're getting draft position for next year, picking up a guy you can keep, whatever it is, you're going for the money. Keep doing it. Your opponents are playing football. Your opponents are checking out. You can pass people just by showing up. Never more true than right now. Hope you enjoyed this podcast. We'll be back at you soon.